from the Biggest Geekest. I'm your host, Randy. I'll be flying solo tonight. My homeboy Joe is a bit under the weather. So this is episode 48 of our podcast. The date is Wednesday, August 11th, 2021. So this is going to be a real experiment. You're just going to hear the you are hearing the talent side of the pair, so that's positive. But technical man is not here, so this could get a little squirrely. So let's see how this goes. Today, I'm going to change things up a bit. Probably going to be a little on the shorter side, I'm assuming. It's kind of weird when you're used to bouncing off one guy and he's not there. So you're talking into space. We shall see exactly how this goes. So anyway, I'm going to kind of do a new segment. I'm going to call it the Plane of Concordant Opposition, the Outlands. So, a quick search on Wikipedia on the internet, I came up with this. If you're a Planescape fan, you know the Plane of Concordant Opposition or the Outlands. This says the Concordant Domain of the Outlands, also known as the Concordant Opposition, was the center of the great will of the outer planes. It is connected to all other planes and was truly neutral in alignment. Other names for the plane were the Outlands, God's Land, and Friendly Opposition. But basically, it was a little balance of power. There's good, evil, and neutral all around. And so this segment's going to have a little bit of everything. I'm going to do call-ins in this segment as well and respond to them. But I want you to brace yourself. You may get a little rawness from Randy, so you may feel a little negative at times. It's definitely going to have some positive stuff to it. So I'm going to start with something that's somewhere in between. Last podcast, we talked about Laurel Hubbard, the heavyweight lifter in the Olympics, the male that competed in the female division. I know she's transgender, so I guess they want to counter that. She did not finish. So I guess I'm going to owe Belle of Lost Souls an apology, as they were correct that she would not win. And Wang Zuyu won the event, about 270 kilograms total in the clean and jerk. And what else did they do? There's another clean and jerk, and then the something or other. Anyway, there's two events, and they total them up, and she had 180 kilograms. Now, I will say that her 180 kilogram in the clean and jerk barely beat the 61 kilogram winner man at 172 kilograms. And you might think, wow, that's still pretty impressive, except he only had one leg. So I think I'm going to say we're still kind of right. Hubbard was the transgender competitor, was 43, looked out of shape. But then again, at 87 plus at the heavyweight division, I'm not throwing stones. At the heavyweight division, out of shape is kind of can be a misnomer anyway. They look heavy, but they're still super strong. And that Chinese gal that won was ridiculously powerful. I thought that was impressive. There's clearly distinct biological difference between men and women, and I don't really care what anybody says about that. So Hubbard was 43. They can't compete in 20 years. He was just in the last year or so getting back in shape, and he was pretty good in the junior events when he did compete. So, but I still won't take anything away from her. Beat Hubbard. So by her, I mean the winner, Chinese woman. I'm not going to call Hubbard a female because I just don't believe she is. So anyway, that's that. I want to get to some call-ins and then we'll do some other stuff. So let me see if I can get this done correctly without my technical master. We'll see how this rolls. Sharing my screen here. So I'm going to start with a little call in from John Allen Large. Love hearing from that dude. Take it away, John.
Hey guys, it's John here from the Red Dice Diaries. To answer your questions about how much I'm prepping in terms of dungeons, at the start of a hex crawl, I'll have maybe the few hexes around where the players are, with like two or three like little points of interest that they can go to, whether that's dungeons, monster lairs, whatever. When it comes to prepping dungeons, I don't tend to go for like really massive dungeons, certainly not first off, because unless you're running like a mega dungeon campaign, I mean, people like a little bit of variety and like a bit of wilderness and a bit of sort of interaction with NPCs and a bit of dungeon and whatever. So quite often, to be honest, I'll just go on something like the Waterloo like one page dungeon generator. I'll be like, boom, there's a dungeon generated. I'll make a few notes, roll a few like random things to populate it, maybe tie them together with a bit of a sort of rough background. Boom, that's my dungeon ready for that. I can get that done in about half an hour, to be honest, like per dungeon. And that's if I'm taking my sweet time about it. Anyway, I'm going to get back to your episode, guys. Take it easy.
John, that's what I was thinking the way you were talking last time, which, by the way, guys, I know we missed last week. We had some things going on that could not be avoided. We just couldn't get to the podcast. Hopefully we're going to keep this going here at episode 48. 50 is only two away, which, by the way, the contest of champions is up. We'll get to that in a moment. But yeah, John, I thought the way you were talking, having these several dungeons ready, that makes sense. You would do that. I have done something like that, but again, I tend to be super anal. And I recall, being a math guy, I mean, this is not anything original. This was just some weird name I came up with. I thought of my style of dimming using a matrix style campaign where you can move in any direction, forward, backward, left, right, up, down, and I have something ready. I know that at times I had prepped. Again, I'm a big fan of modules. I like to read them, like to use them. I definitely heavily manipulate them. But I had fully prepped three Dungeon Magazine modules completely ready for the very first session, depending on which the players, you know, chose. And they could have chose none of those. It would have been hard because I kept, you know, the people they met were kind of the ones connected to the adventures. But in my players in the past, generally pretty good about following following the script. That's what I'm talking about. Gosh, do what I tell you. No, they're pretty good about participating in the game, being a part of it, not just trying to, I'm going to do my own thing every time. So don't railroad me. So, but yeah, John, I get that. You would definitely use the little one-page dungeons and other things like that. And again, you don't, yeah, you may not want to start off like I did or start off with a big dungeon when your player's like, yeah, I'm not sure that's how we're going to roll. We might want to do political intrigue. So I'm definitely with you on that. Our next call is from Patrick. So let's give that a listen.
Hey guys, it's your boy Pat. I just wanted to let you know that the mustachioed individual whose name you are looking for is Ron Swanson. And yes, he is from Parks and Rec. He is also my spirit animal. Joe, just to let you know that his piece of paper of I do what I want is not just a meme. In that particular episode, Ron wants to gut, clean and cook a pig on park grounds, and the sheriff tells him that he can't, and he brings a note with him that basically just says I do what I want, mainly because he's the head of the parks department. All right, catch you guys later, bye.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick. That is pretty, I didn't know Ron Swanson. I don't watch Parks and Rec much, but I'm glad at least we had the show right. You know, today especially, I've been feeling the frustration with all the governmental mandates and people infringing on your rights. And I'm definitely feeling like that card may have to go in my wallet. And I know when you say it, I do what I want, people get themselves a little bit been out of shape because they're like, well, who do you think you are? Well, I'm just governing me. You know, I do what I want for me. It doesn't mean I'm going to step on your toes. It doesn't mean I'm going to make your life miserable. But in this day and age, sometimes that's hard to avoid. All right, we got another couple from Jason. And again, this is the plane of concord and opposition for those that are just tuning in. It's not the positive material plane, so there's going to be some ugly here. Not saying that Jason did it, but there might be some negative stuff. So if you need to, shut it down.
Hey, guys, as far as dragons go, I think you did a great job covering them. I like them to be unique. So not that there's one dragon, but each dragon is unique and along unto themselves. But yeah, great job covering that. As far as the White Wolf games go, as a whole, I'd say extra small for me. I'd never played one. I've actually never played one. And I mean, I've skimmed through the books. I remember when they were happening back in the day, but we were playing Cyberpunk 2020 and D&D and Call of Cthulhu at the time, to be honest. So really in those games, really it's a lot of politics, like with the vampire, it's a lot of house politics between houses, stuff like that. And I'm not really into that kind of game. So it just never appealed to me.
if somebody was running it and I could join the game, like say John was at large was running game and I didn't work my schedule, I would definitely give it a shot. I'd be interested in trying, but at the moment it's extra small.
I think that's pretty fair. To be honest with you, I don't, I wouldn't call it extra small for me. I've had a good time a couple of times I've played it. That's mainly because I like my friends and they're fun no matter what. But as Joe and I said, I definitely feel you. And the politics gets a little bit heavy-handed and a little annoying. And I guess I'm not fond of games where the group is at odds all the time. And I feel like in Vampire, each character it wouldn't be inconceivable that every character vampire at the table is literally an enemy of the others. So that, or at least against them all. And I guess, if you like it, that's great. But yeah, I'm with you, Jason. That ain't much for me either. All right, Jason again.
Hey guys, Jason here. So to finish out the podcast or negative material plane, as far as the canon thing, I mean, obviously they can set the canon for their, their novels and their campaigns and things like that. And there's no problem with that. And obviously no game company can set the canon for your home game. So I don't see what the issue is. If you'd like those books back in the day, I didn't, but I read like the not Strahd. Who's the Death Knight? Anyway, I read the book about the Death Knight. I think I might have read the book about Strahd, and I think that's about all the books I read. But no, I read one about Drizzt, and I wasn't impressed. But anyway, if you like those old books, then you still have them, and you can still read them. So the new books don't hurt that. Just ignore the new stuff. No biggie, but definitely not anything to get up in arms over.
Yeah, that Knight of the Black Rose, I think, was the book you're talking about, Jason. That's Lord Soth. I did enjoy them. And you're right, dude. If you like those things, which a lot of that old canon I like, I use it. It's no big deal. Do what you want. You can do Raven Soft if you want to. Doesn't hurt my feelings, son.
I can see you getting disappointed in a favorite creator that, changes the direction they're headed in. But let's be honest. These days, all of our heroes are breaking our hearts, right? So what can you do? As far as Masters Universe, I haven't watched it all, but yeah, I really think, again, what do you expect? The titling, although what's the title? I'll have to go back and look. I'll look for the next segment. If it's just Masters of the Universe, and I guess you can't complain. If it's called He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, then I guess that's probably a pretty valid complaint, or you should call it Teal and the Masters of the Universe.
I would say you do have a valid complaint, and I'm not even a He-Man. I am not a He-Man fan. I was way too old for that, but you're right. They're subverting all the old characters because they don't have any new ideas. So that's my thoughts. But you're right, Jason. What can you do?
According to Wikipedia, it's just called Masters of the Universe Revelation. So they didn't even mention He-Man in the title. Whatever. Again, I don't see that as a huge, it shouldn't surprise you that any show, any media coming out now is going to have, the same talking points. So, I don't know that they misrepresented it that bad, but whatever. Now, as far as I'm not saying that it, your points are invalid. I'm just pointing out that, did you expect something different? I know that sounds kind of negative, but it is a negative material plane. Dun, dun, dun.
Right on, Jason. No surprise. Yeah, it's no surprise. We shouldn't be shocked. Honestly, I just would expect something better from Kevin Smith, but maybe I'm silly on that one. I always have hopes, but this was not on my radar, though, to be fair. I mean, I wasn't looking for this. I didn't care if they made it or not. I just had heard it from several other places and friends of mine. I got several friends of mine that have watched it. And they were just beside themselves, disgusted with it. So, but I think we may have some people today that have different opinions, and that's okay. If you like it, dude, knock stuff out. Oh, before we move on to any more of Jason's calls, I want to pause and talk about the Contest of Champions. That's not what we're calling it, but I like that term. Our contest is live. I talked to Joe. Everything's ready to go. You can go to thegeekistpodcast.com. You can click on that contest. You can put your email in there. You have a chance to win prizes, which we'll be drawing for in our 50th episode, hopefully in 2 weeks from now. The three prizes is one of the following: Waterdeep Dragon Heist, the 5e adventure for levels 1 to 5. Feng Shui 2, an RPG, I think, is it by Robin Laws, I believe. And then Labyrinth Lord Advanced Edition Companion. So a little OSR, a little new flavor with Feng Shui, and a little big gorilla in the room 5e action. So you'll be able to choose between one of those three prizes, and I will ship it to you as soon as I can. So, yeah, get in there. I want to roll a D100.
Last comment to do with the Olympics. So I will admit ignorance to this, and I have not researched it, so I don't know. Is there evidence, scientific evidence, that when somebody transitions, it changes their testosterone? Is there scientific evidence that says somebody that transitions into woman, you know, is going to be weaker, not have the muscle mass and all that? If there is, then that should be considered. If there's not, and we take all these arguments at face value, then why do we still have segregated sports? Why do we still have men's and women's sports? If there's no difference, then have everybody compete against each other and see where we fall. But if there's a change after transition, then that should be considered. If not, then, you know.
Well, I know I've read some on this. I've listened to a couple of PhD from Harvard specialist, and she studied testosterone, which is the main thing, the main hormone in males, and makes a difference in all the muscle mass and stuff. If a male's gone through puberty, it's over. They lose it at most just a tiny percent of their testosterone. Their muscle mass doesn't change, not really change. It does change a little bit. Their bone structure does not change. Testosterone level drops small, she said, very little. And at best, you could hope would be a 40% drop. And that's high, high end. So, gosh, maybe misquoting the numbers exactly, but I know it was ridiculously small. People can do whatever they want. Not my daughter. If I had any say so about it, nah, that's ridiculous. You don't compete against men. It's not fair. I don't care what he says. And I'm sure, like I said earlier today, you know, Wang Zhu is pretty awesome weightlifter. I'm heavyweight. She kicked my butt. But you know what? She's really nothing compared to the men. So, yeah, that's my take on it.
So that's where I stand with the Olympics thing. If there is no physical difference before and after the transition, well, then if you're not going to have all men and women compete together, then I think you have your answer. If there is a physical change to muscle mass and testosterone, then I guess that needs to be considered. I have not done the research, so I cannot speak any more intelligently or any less intelligently than I just did. You guys keep up the great work. Look forward to your next show.
Yeah, Jason, I don't think you have to do much research. Science is based on observable data. And it's been proven forever. Testosterone's the deal, man. It's the deal. So when it comes to muscle mass, strength, lung capacity, I haven't done anything. I'm not a professional, but I know the changes that they measure were like, if you had to have a 5% nanomoles per liter or what, I don't know what the measurement was, but of testosterone in blood, I don't know how it worked, but it doesn't change the fact that your bone density is different if you're a male, and your muscle masses. I mean, you're physically different, but hey, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. It's kind of like He-Man. So I guess in the end, just let them do it.
Hey there, guys. It's John here from the Red Dice Diaries. Just listening to you talking about World of Darkness. And yeah, I've played World of Darkness since pretty much the 90s, although not so much in recent years. I've been leaning more towards the OSR stuff and Fate. But yeah, played loads of it, particularly in my teens, my sort of early 20s, stuff like that. And I used to play quite a lot of the Vampire sort of Mind's Eye Theater, as it was called, which is the LARP version. And yeah, they used the whole like rock, paper, scissors for the rules. The weird thing about the game that was, it was originally designed as a sort of parlor game, certainly the vampire one, where you'd sort of like, you'd be playing like sort of Camarilla, like high up vampires sat around making the decisions, moving your influence and stuff like that. And most sort of like active stuff in inverted commas would like happen in the downtime. It was more a discussion game, you know, you could play in the back of a pub or something like that. But at some point, it started to take on more of the trappings of a normal TTRPG. The only problem with that was the rules really sucked ass when it came to like doing anything that was supposed to be fast-paced, like combat, for instance, because you can imagine you get into a combat, each person's going to do like rock, paper, scissors, they've got to call out traits, and I won't get into all the rules, but it was basically a very complicated rule system, which was trying to sort of sidestep the having to roll dice in a LARP, because you don't really want to be doing that. And they sort of went for a compromise solution, which worked as long as you're only doing like the odd sort of test here or there. But if you broke into a combat, the whole game would bog down. It's just like being really, really slow and turgid to the point where you'd almost do anything, or certainly I would, in games like that to avoid a combat or stack the deck in your favor just to like get through it as quickly as possible rather than have a whole session taken up with that, which resulted in some interesting situations, but it had a very sort of particular vibe to the game.
Yeah, John, I know you're into LARP, dude, and but you're making it sound like it's a little kind of complex, but I got to pause. Am I hearing an owl in the background there? Because if I am, super cool.
Which certainly in the games I played tended to be, you'd have like your big sort of vampire, like Camarilla, Sabbat meeting, whatever you want to call it, in like your Elysium or whatever. There'd be there sort of jockeying for position and like discussion of what was going on. There'd inevitably be at least one sort of fight, normally against some sort of like enemy, like werewolves are always a perennial favorite. And then you'd all sort of slink away at the end and you'd do your downtimes. And I mean, this was in the days sort of like before the internet was like a really, really big thing. So, you know, you'd be getting like printed downtime returns from the GM and stuff telling you like what all your sort of machinations have been doing. You know, you drop them off in a little like letterbox thing at the local game store to submit your downtime actions. And it was all really good fun. I've got a certain fondness for it because it's one of the first games I played when I was getting back into gaming again. And I made a lot of friends through that, unfortunately, a lot of whom I'm no longer in touch with. But at the end of the day, like I say, despite having fond memories of it, for me, it was one of those games where you sort of had fun despite the rules rather than the rules enhancing the fun. They were just a sort of least worst solution. I've got very fond memories of it, and I doubt I'll ever play it again, but I've still got my books. And like I say, I made some good friends from it and had a really great time doing it. And at the end of the day, what more could you ask for? Anyway, I'm going to go back to listening to the rest of the episode, guys. Keep up the good work, and I'll catch you soon.
Right on, John. If you dig it, man, play it. That's cool. I guess I didn't see the complexity in the vampire rules. In fact, I kind of like the rules that I saw with the dots. I'm talking the Masquerade. I haven't done the other two other versions besides that. Oh, there was a first and second edition of Masquerade and then Requiem. And then what's the new one? I don't know. But I played Masquerade. I thought the rules were pretty straightforward, but I was told by the guys in the group that liked it more that they got pretty weird. So there might be something to that. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's not my cup of tea, though. The setting is cool. I mean, it's like Underworld. I think it's awesome, but I just didn't enjoy playing it. Not liking playing monsters, but you know, it's a totally different vibe, and I get it. And the LARP thing really hit me weird when I was younger. I just thought it was, you know, look, I played D&D. Who might have called someone else weird? But I was like, I don't know what these guys are doing. But now that I've actually been in kind of quasi-LARPs once or twice, they're fun. It's really immersive. You try to get into your character more because you don't have much else to do. So, yeah, I get it. Let me know about the owl, though. I want to know. Is that an owl back there? Or am I just hearing things? Oh, no. Joe from Hindsightless. always got some Masters of the Universe stuff.
Yo, what up, dudes? Just calling in about your episode on dragons. Yeah, I gotta say, I grew up loving He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. It was one of my favorites. I mean, hell, at one point in the 80s, it was the number one toy in the world as far as sales goes. And the new show is kind of meh. I give it maybe a 5, only because of the ending. The ending is amazing. But you should probably watch it before you start running your mouths off about it, because you're wrong in a lot of the stuff you say. It is in no way on any soapbox. It's not Teela versus the patriarchy by any means. Teela's friend is not her girlfriend. It's just a companion. I mean, it's a shame you can't see two women together and think they're just friends. But yeah, it's not great, but the ending is amazing.
Fair enough, Joe. Maybe I will force. When I say force myself, it's not because all the bad that I've heard about it. And that's fair. I've not watched it. You are not being unfair at all. And that's cool that you think that. It may not be. I'm quoting some other people that said that. I do have a couple of friends. I'm just not the target audience, but I may have to sit and watch it, because if you're saying it's not that, and I got several other friends that says it absolutely is and they watched it, I'll be intrigued, because I have to admit the animation looks a lot better than back in the day just from the commercial. But maybe it's not that. Maybe I do need to listen to it. Maybe I need to watch it. But my gut says I'm not wrong, but maybe you are. But we'll see. You've watched it, so you get a +5.
Yeah, and He-Man is in pretty much every single episode. The main crux of the story is rescuing He-Man, so it is still a He-Man-focused story, although the name of the show in nowhere says He-Man. Yeah, so I don't know. Another thing you guys might enjoy is there is a very strong Christian theme running throughout the entire 5 episodes. The show is very, if anything, what the show is saying, the platform, the soapbox that the show is on is saying technology is bad and faith is the only way forward. I think you guys would maybe enjoy that. They also, for no reason whatsoever, refer to the afterworlds in this universe as heaven and hell, even though the afterworlds have other names in the universe, but they still call it heaven and hell.
Okay, well, oh, you're enticing me now more, Joe. Okay, buddy, I got you. When I'm done tonight, I may just put that first episode on.
Yeah, so while the show isn't great, a lot of it isn't all that good. The ending is worth the watch. There's only 5 episodes right now. They're all less than half an hour long. There is no agenda whatsoever. The people that are saying that are lying. They are absolutely lying. And yeah, dudes, you guys should have watched it before you started running your mouths, because what you were saying about it was wrong. It was not correct. And it just made you both look a little foolish. So, you know, it's good to absorb media, kind of get ideas about something. But before you form a strong opinion about a piece of media or something, maybe check it out first. You might see that other people are pushing their agendas. Peace out.
Oh, that's very possible. I admit that I could be wrong. I don't think I'm going to find that to be true. But having said that, you are right. We should watch it. Even though, like I said, you know, not the target audience, never a fan of He-Man. So I won't probably, after I watch it, which if it's a half an hour long, I may watch it all tonight, because I think you're right. You should watch things. Having said that, I'm not going to like the show, no matter how, but I might say, hey, that's okay. For people that like it, it's cool. I didn't like He-Man ever, but that's not why I'm going to knock it. You know why I knocked it. So yeah, maybe I'll have to eat some crow. And if I do, bud, I'll be the first to admit it. I am not too good to admit that I could be wrong about something. But even friends that I trust said no. So let me look at it and I'll give it a shot and I'll come back and, maybe you'd be right, Joe. Who knows? Thanks for calling in, bud. Thanks for everybody for calling in. It's really great. Thanks, Jason and John Allen and Joe from Hindsightless. So really helped. A couple more things before we leave the plane of Concord and opposition. Some more positive things. And by the way, I just want to say, love how Joe told me I need to wash stuff before I open my mouth. That is cool. I'm fine with that. I think he's That's a very it's actually very respectful. And I think he said before he's not sure we'd agree on much, which is fine. But we can disagree like that all day long, Joe. I'm completely cool with it. Anyway, Concordant Opposition. Taylor last week had told me about, or even the week before, had sent me a link, and I had bought Goblin Henchman's usage die for hit points, and I took a good look at it. I think mathematically it's pretty strong. It is very reasonable. There are some issues that I think Goblin's Henchman tackled pretty well, at least mentioned con modifiers, how to deal with big damage creatures like Dragon Breath or a Giant Strike. Again, I'm not going to talk too much detail about the actual mechanic. Just want to answer Taylor's questions or kind of tell him that I haven't spent the time on it. Overall, I would like to try it where, you know, you roll a certain number, you got a target number at each level. So it's kind of like in the Black Hack where I'll say you have a D8 and I don't have it in front of me, but you have a D8 for your hit points. You don't roll that number. You just have that as your hit point die. And so maybe a fighter at first level has to get a 3 or higher. When he gets hit, he has to get a 3 or higher or he gets wounded, and he can only take one wound and he's down. So you could roll 3 or higher lots of times, or you could stink it up and die right off the bat, which is not much different than any other first level game where they could roll low damage and you could, you know, die in one, you know, roll high damage, you could die in one shot. So it's not bad. And I think it's mathematically pretty sound, but it makes it a different game. So every class, fighter, wizard, fighter, magic user, thief and cleric, and this is in Goblin's Henchmen did it all based upon 1E D&D. They have different levels of hit dice. Give me a second here. Again, I'm not a savvy guy when it comes to computer stuff, but you guys know that I'm just, you know, the pretty face and the talent. So let me get in here. Joe's going to love that part. And let me try to find where this is. Here it is. Hit points replacing the usage die. And since I'm feeling particularly savvy right now, I'm going to share this for those of you on the tubes of you. And you have these tables here below. So here's the fighter's table. And it's like an old attack matrix for those that are just listening. And a first level fighter actually has a D4. And he has to get a 3 or higher. So every time he gets hit, he drops down one usage die. Well, unfortunately, he only has one usage die to begin with, each standard damage. So, you know, approximately D6. Whereas if you compare that to a six level fighter, when he gets hit, he has to roll an 8 on a D8, but failing that, he goes to a D6 and he has to get a 4 or higher. And so the idea is this. So suppose he gets hit 3 times in a row and he rolls 8, 8, and 8 each time he gets hit. He essentially takes no damage. Then he gets hit again, and he rolls a D8 for damage, and he rolls an 8. So his usage die will drop down to a D6, because at 6th level, he gets to have a D8 usage die. And now with a D6, he has to roll a 4 or higher. So he gets hit again, and let's say he rolls a 5. Next battle, he gets hit, and he rolls a 5. And he gets hit again, and he rolls a 2. Then his usage die will drop down to a D4. But it's 2 or higher on a D4. When he fails that, it drops again. And fighters, I think clerics maybe, I know fighters for sure, they have a special fortitude die, a D2 beginning at 5th level, where they got to get a 50-50 chance. They got to get a 2 on a D2, or probably using a D6, odd even. But when that goes down, he's gone. So to tell you how good it can get, at least in the chart that Goblin did, at 10th level, a fighter would start with a D8 usage die, and he'd have to roll a 2 or higher. So he's not going to drop a usage die until he rolls a 1. So that's pretty awesome. Whereas a magic user at 10th level, he gets a D8, but he has to roll a 4 or higher, even at 10th level. And then he drops to a D6, and he's got to get a 3 or higher. Then he drops to a D4, and he has to get a 4, and he doesn't have that extra D2. So I don't think the thief or the magic user gets it. So essentially what this does then, guys, is this is going to make the game, I think, a little swingy, but not mathematically not more swingy than others, but it'll feel that way, especially for the poor person who rolls a one and then a one. Someone like, say, me or our buddy Jeff, a few other us out there don't roll so. We don't think we roll so well. We probably really do over time. But yeah, it's interesting. I think it might be less ideal for high fantasy, but for a little bit of, you know, life is cheap sort of, you know, game, I think it could work really well. So yeah, the usage die is not bad. I'm not sure how many of my fellow gamers, my buddies that I game with, Taylor, would want to play that, but I'm willing to try it. So anyway, that's my thoughts on the usage die. I thought Goblin Henchman did a good job and it was pretty cool. Last thing, Concordant Opposition, ending on a high note. I played D&D on, when was this? Monday. And my buddy Tim and his two sons played. In fact, Tim's son, who's 11, ran the game for us. And we used what he likes to call the Zeroth Edition. So, buddy, awesome. We had a good time. He DM'd us. We played for two, three hours. And we died multiple times. Little dude had no compassion on us. We were five first level swords and wizardry characters, and yeah, boy, we got smoked. Three ain kegs, it's quite a challenge for five first level characters, and a handful of orcs with a ogre type leader, or at least the power of an ogre, pretty challenging. But I say, well done, sir. You are definitely the master DM, or at least you're on your way. Good job, Tim's son. All right. So for the podcast today, to move on to the next segment, I'm going to do a game review, something we've not done before. I have actually written up a game review for this game. It's called Ankur, A-N-K-U-R, The Kingdom of the Gods. It's soon to be a Kickstarter on September 1st, I believe, according to the author, Chris Miller. I became friends with Chris on Facebook about a month or two ago in the I'm on a conservative RPG site. I know that shocks people. You would think I would be on a super, super progressive one because, you know, all my beliefs are clearly, you know, lean that way. Anyway, I was given a free PDF to review, and I wrote a pretty detailed review of the mechanics and such on www.biggestgeekestpodcast.com. Check it out. It should have been up a day or two ago. By the way, I want to thank Chris. I'm so embarrassed to say this. I made a mathematical error in my review. And you say, but Randy, why is that such a problem? Dude, I'm a math teacher. Really, it was an editing problem. But I did fix it. And he gave me a heads up. So hopefully I fixed it before too many folks saw it. Anyway, what is this game about? Well, it's a science fantasy game. It's got hints of Lovecraft and Ron Howard. Howard, Conan fame, Robert E. Howard. And it reminds me a lot of Stargate, though. And Chris is clearly into Sumerian mythology. He's I think he's an old school gamer, but not fully. I thought he really dug in there, and he made that world come alive. I thought it was really well written that way. The fluff is very intriguing. It can be a little, you can get a little lost in the naming conventions. A lot of strange names, like, what is it? The Nibruin, I believe, is the Nibruin are this group of aliens that come from another world. They come to Earth, which is called Ki or Kai, K-I. And, they create the race of man and a variety of races of men. It's mostly variants on humans, some big, some small. They kind of have the tropes at least attached to them of standard fantasy races, but not fully. I think it is a good job to make them feel kind of different. They took the hominids that were on the Earth this time. This is back in way, I don't know how many thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago, maybe hundreds of thousands, and they created the mankind and made them as slaves and had them mine this thing called mana for them, which can only be obtained from gold and silver. And then these Nibruin would, of course, take those and take advantage of it. And then somewhere there was a great flood event, like in the Bible, but like in a lot of cultures, there's a flood event. and the Nibiruin go, hey, we're out of here, and left the creatures they created, which they called the Lee, what do they call the Luki? Let me make sure I get that right. Luki, yeah. Or Lukai, I'm not sure you say it, but anyway, left them to their fate, came back 25,000 years later, I believe. I hope I'm getting the numbers right. There's hundreds of thousands of years of history here. And they came back and found these folks. Some of them had survived. And their ruler at the time, the emperor of these alien people, said, hey, we surely shouldn't enslave them like that. And, you know, not as harsh. So they got a little better, lifestyle. They got to be servants and soldiers and such. It still didn't sound great. There's still some of them that are barbarian types that will fight, that are against the their gods. I think Chris did a heck of a job with this. As far as the flavor, it's really good. His writing is pretty intriguing. I think the book is easy to read. It was 300 and something pages, and I got through it in a couple of nights. I would say that the main mechanic was a real eye-opener. He said he didn't want to use a D20 because at the time he first wrote this, this is not a second edition, he said. It's kind of a second printing, which he's going to use Kickstarter for. And if you're into science fantasy, I would say this might, especially if you think, if you like some to have some real original setting with cool, rich names that don't just sound like Bill, Bob said in this world, but real unique names with someone that seems to really know this. This is a game that you might be into. It uses a D12. That's its system. It's the only die you roll, and I think the only one you need. And there's a target number that you create based upon your attributes. These are called aptitudes. And anyway, forgive me. I'm getting bombarded, of course, even though I had turned it down, but apparently I'm stupid. So anyway, you use aptitudes. So we're talking things like brawn and... oh gosh, I'm blanking on these, on the 5 or 6, 7 different attributes. Agility, toughness, perception, intellect, spirit, influence, and speed. And then you take that attribute and you add it to a skill circle, just like a rank, if you will. Though in this setting, there's a lot of guilds and you get trained a lot. You have to kind of train up. It's really got that old school feel of whenever you, quote unquote, gain enough experience points and you want to train up and level up, you have to go to a master and be trained or get access to some cool, fancy, high-tech, fancy machine. It's a lot like a computer, and it will teach you. I think that's how it works. But anyway, so you take your aptitude numbers, which range between 1 and 5, your skill circle between 1 and 9, add them together, and that's your target to roll. It's a roll under system. On the website, I go into greater detail as to how that works. There are numbers above 5 for aptitudes, but I think that's limited mainly to the Nibiruin, those aliens, the more powerful, which they are powerful. They're more powerful than the humans. Their technology helps them tremendously. So does that mana. But it uses a hit point system, not unlike D20 Star Wars, the first or second one that had vitality and wounds. So you have two sets of pools of stamina, physical and spiritual. So when you do physical things, your stamina can drop. But dropping your stamina to 0 doesn't take you to wound, doesn't mean you get any wounds, but you can have some weapons and some attacks that go directly to wounds. So you have physical stamina and wounds, and then you have spiritual stamina, because in this setting, the only kind of quote unquote magic besides technology is psionic power, so mental abilities. And there's a whole spiritual feel, and I'll talk about ghosts in a second, but anyway, you have a spiritual stamina where you have a will and a willpower and be able to, that can drop as well. I did think, looking at the numbers seem large. His example was like someone rolling up 125 points worth of physical stamina and wounds, so 125 of each, if I read it right, and maybe Chris can correct me, and 125 or 100 something spiritual stamina. It seems like a lot of points to wade through, but he has, in combat, you'll be burning through those points pretty fast to do cool things. One thing I want to mention, in combat, you use your speed number, and that could be 4, 5, 6 for somebody. That's how many actions you get. But you got to burn stamina to do more than one action. So I think there's – I've not played it, but I think that might be a pretty good control mechanism. Movement and combat is fairly well detailed in the system, and he literally has martial arts moves, combat maneuvers of all sorts of stripes based on your skills. Psionics, as I said before, he's got this kind of theme, the Arthur C. Clarke theme of any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic sort of vibe going through the game. So you definitely will see a cool a ray gun, like a pointy stick, and then it shoots out a laser or something, and that's pretty cool. There's some mysticism, as I mentioned before. If you die, you can continue playing your character as a ghost, and ghosts feed on the blood of the living. I think through their stamina. Sounds kind of horrifying, but it reminded me a little bit of Ghost Walk from the third edition, 3.5, I think 3.5 D&D book by Sean Reynolds. Just the idea of being able to continue that way, but it's definitely an option. So I'm guessing that maybe the combat's pretty deadly. Looking at the weapons, each weapon has a toughness. Your armor has a toughness, and their toughness is the damage they're dealt. It can be pretty bad because if they beat, you have like kind of two defenses, your toughness based on armor, and then you had your PDR. I'm trying to remember, did I write that down? It's like your personal defense resistance or something. I can't remember what it stands for. But if they roll high enough, they can bypass your toughness and go straight to, let's say roll well enough, because it's a roll under system. And they can go straight to your PDR and you can get some wounds. So it can be deadly, I think. I think it can be deadly. There's 5 human-like species. He doesn't use the word race. Uses species, the Luki, and they were created, as I said, from the Nibiruin. This is an alien race from this planet Nibir, and they're kind of like gods, referred to as gods, but they're basically just powerful and highly respected overlords right now. It goes on into detail the various types. They have a very big and hulking Luki. They have the smaller, tiny guy. So to me, it sounds like it's got a lot of parallels to standard D&D races. There are 7 castes, a caste system, which is like classes you can play. Things like there's healers and there's warrior soldiers and there's psionicists, but he uses really cool names like Lagaru for healer and Garadum, if I'm saying it right, for soldier, and Irhandi for psionicist. So each one has their own unique name, but in parentheses, he describes what it is. But so I think that's pretty good. I think it can be challenging to read because he uses a lot of those words and just assumes you can follow along. And I know my wife and some other players that I play with sometimes get overwhelmed because I try to throw a lot of my own unique names and towns, and I just, frivolously use them and refer to them. They're like, what are you talking about? Talking about the tall, bald guy? Yeah, that's him. So I appreciate it, but I'm a DM, so I think that's really cool. I'd mentioned the setting, which is pretty neat. The key element, and I'm not, no puns in here, is an element called mana. It's manufactured from gold and silver, as I said before, and they can only get it on Kai or Ki, I believe now. I think their home planet has been mined completely. They use it, they consume it. You can even consume that yourself, and that will literally improve some of your abilities, but it's dangerous for the human-like, the Luki, to do those, though. The Nibiruin can do it. I think as far as Rife with Adventure, there's a political intrigue thing going here. I think you could easily be a group of rebels going up against the status quo and fighting these gods, if you will, which are just advanced aliens from another race. You could play a game of politics between the different guilds. Every caste, I think, has a guild associated with it. And so that's played up. So I think political intrigue is big. I think Chris clearly likes that. I think his writing style, as I said, is easy to follow. I think the book has decent art. I really like the maps. There's good star system maps. There's a good overarching land maps. I think I would have liked some kind of physical map if I were to buy the book. That would come along with it, but I understand, hey, that's expensive stuff. I don't know if he's going to have an adventure in the GM's guide, because in the second printing, he split the book into a player's guide and a GM's guide. I've only had the player's guide, so maybe that's stuff that's coming out later. I guess I haven't played it yet, but just on the read-through, and I have taken my time to read through again, let me direct you to www.biggestgeekuspodcast.com, and you can read the review in more detail. You'll see some of the numbers. I go through a core mechanic or two. I give some more opinions, maybe more detail on the setting. But I'm going to attempt to rank it, and I'm going to use our ranking system. It goes from extra small to 2X, and I think I would have to, if, you know, forced to rank this, put this at the medium. It's okay. I think I would only play it for a while. I love the setting. The mechanic is pretty cool. Again, I'm not going into great detail on that D12 mechanic. It's because it sounds like it could get kind of weird, but he's got some pretty cool control bumpers on that D12. I think if my friends at the table were really into it, then I'd be worried with all the names. I think we could play a full-blown campaign, so it might become large. I'd love to see the GM's guide and find out what it is. I'm going to back it on Kickstarter. I like Chris. I think it's pretty good. I think it's pretty cool. I want to help out creators, and I'm excited to see what his Kickstarter looks like. I'm sure he has to be a little more careful. He's not one of the big boys, but I'm going to give it a medium or a large. Leaning toward medium, I haven't played it yet. After I played it, probably would become a large, something kind of a sci-fi fantasy that I would love to try. I've never stepped my foot into the sci-fi fantasy realm. No, I don't think ever. So yeah, medium large, which is pretty good for never having played it. All right, guys. Well, I want to do one more segment here. Again, flying solo tonight. I wanted to talk about monogamy or polygamy, and I'm not talking about sexual relationships. Let me say it differently. Monogamy or polygamy, which is better? To play one game only or to play many games? I want to give a nod to Barry at Shadow the GM. He does this awesomely with many of his podcasts where he debates both sides. I'm going to do a little of that, but not nearly as cool as Barry does. If you want to see someone doing it well, you check out Barry. So mono gaming, one game to rule them all, is without doubt the best way to play, because you get mastery, right? One system to rule them all. You have to learn a bunch of rules. You don't confuse them. You just play one game until you know it inside and out. How does grapple work? Page 47, fourth paragraph, it says, I mean, you can get almost to that point. I know when I played first edition D&D, there were times I felt like I knew the monster manual. I could tell you the armor class of a chunk of monsters just from the top of my head, if not a full and complete, you know, detailed analysis. So you master that game and you got it down. Makes preparation easier. You got it mastered, no worries. Less cost. Hey, if you're playing one game, even if you buy all the supplements, at some point, you know, you're going to be done when the game ends, or get everything you want, you know, get those. You're not looking at all the different games, not buying supplements from 9 or 10 different games. So it's going to be less costly. Heck, just buy the core book. If you're the player, buy the player's handbook and go, whatever, boss, I'm playing this. So one game is really awesome for that. You can curate a very finely tuned group. And playing just one game, you can perfect it. You guys can know inside and out. You can be able to know each other very well. And session zero might become moot if you're just playing with one group. It can make a perfectly curated group. If you're going to play with multiple groups, it's still pretty awesome to do one game. You're like, hey, I only run 13th Age. That's all there is. So coming to my table, this is what we're playing. You'll find people that like that, and they'll be like, man, this dude knows this game inside and out. It's the only one he plays. That's all I spend time thinking about. That's a big advantage. And you have to upgrade to a new edition. Just because it's third edition or fourth edition or fifth edition, you don't have to upgrade. Now, you can, but if you don't upgrade, you save even more money. Heck, when third edition ended, 3.x ended, and you're like, dude, or 3.5, let's say. Well, let's say third edition. That was pretty quick, really. So that was a long life cycle. I want to say it was 6 years maybe. And you got all the booklets, all the hardbacks, which there weren't tons. And they ended, and you're like, I like it. This is my game. I'm playing third edition. Did you resent for the rest of your life? And you can refine one game. It's, if you're playing 6, 7, 8, 9 games, you don't have much time to focus on just that one game. You can get in there and you can really know the ins and outs and you can make it your own. That's hard to do that when you're playing a bunch of, 1 week you're playing Aliens and, you know, the next week you're playing, you know, the new Dune game. You play that for 6 months and then you jump off that and you go play Deadlands for 3 weeks. And then you jump off that and you go play a one shot of Hyperborea third edition, which I wish I'm not sure if I wish I'd got that. I kind of do. But yeah, so, you know, you can refine it. You can't do that when you're playing lots of other games. And it should be easier to run a long-lasting campaign. Joe and I belabor a lot about that idea of things we miss from being young, a campaign that would last for years and years. I mean, you could keep a single campaign going forever. You could set your world of Greyhawk or your world of, I don't know, whatever you're set in, Forgotten Realms, or your own campaign world, the Colthia, which I had one called that many years ago, and just play there and just slowly explore every nook and cranny. One game has got its appeal. Of course, polygaming, that's actually without a doubt the best plan. That's what you should do. You get to play so many more games that way. I mean, why just stick with third edition D&D? Play 3.5, play Pathfinder, play 4th edition, play 5th edition. Heck, jump out of that, play Vampire, play Werewolf, play Savage Worlds. Play Feng Shui 2, which I won't be able to play soon after 50th episode. Well, maybe not. Maybe nobody wants it. Kind of hope they do because I don't really want to play it. The variety and exposure is going to make you a better gamer. You're going to see all these mechanics, all these settings. You're really going to get to see a whole bunch of stuff. And you'll be like, oh, that's cool. That's not. I like that. Not so much. That was fabulous. And you can really have a better game in general. You may get to play with a lot of different folks. The D&D folks may not want to play Deadlands. Deadlands folks may not want to play Vampire. But if you're a polygamist, dude, and you're hopping around, you're going to get to play it all with lots of people, good, bad, and ugly. You know, play D&D with Joe, then go play Dungeon World with Joe from Hindsightless. I know after his comments on my opinions of Masters of the Universe, an unlearned opinion that I had, He would probably still have. He would love to have me at his table. So that would be really cool. And lots of other games you could play. Upgrading to a new edition. Heck, if you really like D&D, just upgrade. And when you're gone from second to third to fourth to fifth, and you're like, man, I want something else, go back to first, go back to the original. Heck, go to the clones. Swords and Wizardry. Labyrinth Lord. There's another one we're giving away. Well, the companion. Gosh, what else? You could jump to a myriad of games. What's that? Iron Falcon, I think. Jason talked about that. How cool is that? And you get to kind of stretch your wings and see different little rules and different interpretations of maybe the same rules. I think when you play lots of games, you really learn what type of games you like. And you'll be able to curate your library to those tastes. I mean, at first, sure, you're going to be buying tons and tons of games. It's a little pricey, but just buy core books. And is that really any more expensive than saying, I'm just going to buy 3.5? Well, good luck with that, because there's a boatload of 3.5 books. I'm just going to buy Pathfinder 1. Okay, good luck with that, because there's a truckload of those books too. But if I buy Pathfinder 1, Pathfinder 2, just do the core books and give them a taste, I may eventually realize, look, I'm not really a fantasy guy. I think I want to do Cthulhu. Andy, what do you think, dude? Cthulhu? Sounds good. Who doesn't like trying new games, really? Why would you want to be stuck on one? A long-term campaign is just in danger of growing stale. I mean, how many times can you attack the castle? How many times can you overthrow the evil demon lord and save the world? I mean, only so many times. So who wants that? Anyway, now my real opinion, because those are just defenses and ideas, right? So my real opinion of what this polygamist or a monogamist. I think I'm more a polygamist now. I'm older. When I was younger, I absolutely was not. I was D&D. Yeah, I dabbled in the Traveler, I dabbled in the Marvel Superheroes, but that was a short visit. And it was basically like, nope, out, D&D. And so I played D&D, jumped through all the versions, didn't do fourth edition, punted on that one, rightly so. And I guess right now, D&D that I'm playing is D&D Exploration Edition, aka Mudsword, where I'm trying to figure out what I like. And so I'm going back and exploring old school D&D, you know, white box, first edition. I'm going to try a little Beckme soon. Second edition, whatever the case may be. That's the one game. 13th Age, play that. That feels like the game I can like quickly just go to. If someone says, hey, can you run a game for us? 13th Age is the way I'm going to go. It's just quick to prepare. And then Savage Worlds, something I like about the swinginess, the excitement of every roll. I mean, you're probably going to be successful. It's probably going to be okay, but somebody's dice might explode. And that means somebody or something else is about to get punked. I like that randomness in a game. Those three are my three games of choice. So I was very enamored of Aliens that I played at Cabin Con last year. But those are my three games. Those were in the rotation. I've mentioned that before. So I guess I'm a poly gamer. Do I sometimes, you know, you guys know I've been smitten with the nostalgia bug for a couple of years now. And sometimes I wish I would just go, you know what? Third edition D&D, that's what I'm playing. Screw the rest of it, you know? But right now, I'm probably more of that. Well, what are your thoughts? What do you guys think? I mean, is there something to this? I mean, I imagine from a lot of the people who call in, they play a lot of different games. Does anybody long to be a monogamist? Or are you? Is anybody like, I just play this. I like to talk about other games. I've heard people say, I buy some games and different games, but I play chainmail. I mean, or not chainmail, but white box. Or I play second edition. I would say, Eric Tikar, if you're out there, buddy, if you're hearing me, sounds like you play Swords and Wizardry Light. Though he said he's not opposed to even playing 5e, but it sounds like Swords and Wizardry Light is his jam. Though he's playing a lot of other games too. So anyway, that's all I got to say about that. In fact, that's all I got to say for tonight. It is definitely a shorter episode. Talked a little fast, I know. But time for a little shameless pluggery. If you'd like to support our show, please help get the word out and check out our website, www.biggestgeekispodcast.com. If you're in the mood for hitting on the support tab, go ahead, drop us a little coin. But if not, just share with your friends. We need lots of listeners. Would like more listeners like Jason, like Joe and Heinless, Hein Sightless, and John. Great call-ins. Please call in. We enjoy that. Again, let me say Joe and Hein Sightless, love it. Don't mind if you disagree, and even vehemently. It was well done, sir. Check us out on Odyssey and YouTube as well. Rate us on Apple iTunes. I don't know if other podcasts might let or podcatchers might let you rate them. If you do, rate us, you know, 5 stars, because we tend to not do research and just have an opinion. Our email is thegeeks@biggestgeekispodcast.com. Feel free to send any questions or comments to us. We'd like to encourage you to check out a few podcasts that will be provided at the end. Thanks. Different podcasts, including Barry's that I unabashedly ripped off today, not nearly as well as he does that sort of argue two different sides sort of approach. But hope this has turned out pretty well. Hope you guys enjoyed it. I'm Randy, and for my fellow geek Joe, feel better soon, brother. And remember, if you can't be big like us, be geeks like us.